Afternoon, I'd like to call the House Transportation Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, March 21st, 2023. We're in the Barnes Committee Room, Room 124 of the Alaska State Capitol Building. Let the record reflect that the time is 1:03 p.m. Today we have Representative McKay, Representative Vance, Representative Sumner, Representative Mina, and myself, Chair McCabe. Staff assisting us today are Linda Jensen, as a recording secretary, Zach Lawhorn, a moderator, and Buddy Witt, my committee aide. Thank you, folks, for your service. We have two presentations on today's agenda, but they both are related. First, we will be given a presentation from Isaac Vanderberg, CEO of Launch Alaska, with assistance from Jim Jagger from the Port of Anchorage, Alaska, and Todd Solomon of Zero Avia, both on Teams. Mr. Vandenberg will discuss Launch Alaska's mission in the area of clean hydrogen and its potential in Alaska. We'll then transition to a presentation from Dr. Aaron Whitney, Director of the U.S. Department of Energy's Arctic Energy Office. Any questions from the committee before we begin? Seeing none, Mr. Vandenberg, please come forward, place your name on the record, and begin your presentation. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Isaac Vanderberg, CEO of Launch Alaska. So thank you, first of all, Representative McCabe, for the invitation to present today. We were invited to present to this committee on the work of that our organization does, and also wanted to highlight some of our work and interest in the clean hydrogen hub in the Upper Kakimit of Alaska and talk a little bit about that project. We are also joined today, as you mentioned, by one of the state's foremost experts on energy, but also on hydrogen specifically, Dr. Aaron Whitney from the Arctic Energy Office. She spent a year in Germany learning from some of the kind of leading best practices around hydrogen, and so it's we're very, very grateful for Dr. Whitney to be joining us today as well. So I'm going to just jump into this here, and I'll start with a bit of an overview of Launch Alaska itself and what the organization does. I also, before we start here, I wanted to clarify that we had originally had the folks from Zero Avia and from the Port of Alaska joining, I think, through looking at the amount of content that we wanted to go over. It was recommended that we look at a potential additional hearing for the Port of Alaska and Zero Avia, and they stand by interested in presenting at a later date. I think we made the committee made the call that we just didn't have quite enough time to go over everything. So just wanted to clarify there that's why they're not with us today. So Launch Alaska, we are a nonprofit organization founded in 2016 in Anchorage, Alaska. Our mission is to accelerate the energy transition, which we define as decarbonizing and electrifying industrial transportation and energy systems. You'll find today, I know that this is the committee on House Committee on Transportation. However, we see, an incredible linkage between transportation and energy and industry, and it's very difficult for us to talk about just transportation without talking about the energy context that we're operating within, as well as the industrial context. And so we, our organization, essentially is a deployment accelerator, which is a novel type of organization. I can tell you I'm very aware of what's happening in other innovation communities throughout the country. And I think what we have here in Alaska, where we're working with some cutting edge companies to help them deploy their tech in Alaska, is a very novel approach and something that we can be proud of. And I'll talk a little bit more about why that is later. At the end of the day, though, we are helping companies connect to asset owners in the state, you know, infrastructure owners such as utilities, ports, airports, municipalities, and deploy their technology. And then also the second part of organizations helping to helping some of those same infrastructure owners to get some of their projects moving forward. You know, you may be familiar that there have been a lot of assessments or studies or feasibility work done on different projects throughout the state, but oftentimes those sit on the shelf and don't get moving forward. And so a large part of what our organization does is goes in and works with some of those key infrastructure owners and gets the ball rolling, gets those projects off of High Center and moving forward. We have a great board of directors at Launch Alaska, some of whom you may mention here. They come from ANCs, the private sector, you know, it's a STEM organization there with ANSEP, Tom Shea with Raven Alaska, Joe Jenkinson with McKinley Alaska Private Investments. So a great group, Angela Rodell, formerly with the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. We have great support and great leadership from our board of directors, and many of whom you'd like to recognize. And then we have a small but a rapidly growing team at Launch Alaska. I'm the CEO. We have a executive team that includes a chief operations officer, a partnerships officer, an innovation officer, managing director, Penny Gage, as well as an excellent CFO. And our one thing that's interesting about our team, they're exceptional group of individuals. I know I'm biased, but even though we are working on quote unquote climate tech, looking at ways to decarbonize and electrify our key systems, you know, out of our team, I think 8 or 9 of us have some kind of a background in oil and gas. And I think that that's just very interesting and indicative of the moment in Alaska that we are trying to accelerate this energy transition because we see a huge economic opportunity, and yet we're doing it hand in hand and not in an antagonistic way with the oil and gas sector. I think we all see the same future generally. We may differ at times in what the timeline or approaches are, but I think we all recognize the transition that's underway, and we want to work with all Alaskans to make this happen. Some of our key partners, our organization currently is funded in part with funding from primarily two federal agencies, the U.S. Navy Office of Naval Research, as well as the Department of Energy Office of Tech Transitions. A little less than, I think, around 40% of our budget right now is coming from contracts and fee-for-service type engagements. And so I think about 60% of our budget currently is coming from federal support. The other 40% is coming through these other sources of revenue. McKinley Alaska Private Investment is a key strategic partner, our infrastructure partner. And then we have, you'll see a huge number of partners who are folks that we engage with on an ongoing basis and without whom we could not do our work and are absolutely critical to the work that we do. And we have an objective of facilitating $1 billion of projects in Alaska by 2030. And while this number seemed wildly ambitious when we set it back in 2020, we are, after working on this for a few years, we are feeling very confident that we're going to get there. And I can talk a little bit about why, but again, I think that's indicative of the amount of both public and private investment that's interested in these kinds of projects is really, we've never seen this before, and I think we may never see this again. There's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity right now for Alaska to do some really interesting things. But this is our goal, is to facilitate this level of projects in Alaska by the year 2030. And in our current portfolio of companies, we divided them here into three different verticals or three different sectors: energy, transportation, and industry. Happy to talk about any of these companies if you're interested. They are all high growth startups. And I would just define a startup as a company that is looking to grow very quickly and grow into a major player in an economy, and they are also looking to make some kind of huge impact in one of these, you know, verticals, energy, transportation, industry. I worked for years running a organization called the Small Business Development Center, and I'm a huge believer in small businesses, and they are the pillars of our local economies. Startups, to think about them, are companies that if they're successful and if they grow, they can be the major kind of pillars of economies when they reach their full potential. So just kind of a word on the difference between startups and small businesses.
If I could interrupt for a second, Mr. Vanberg, Representative Mina has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, looking at these portfolio companies, I have two different questions. The first understanding that these are hydro startups, is there any engagement with different oil and gas companies, especially those that are looking into doing smaller hydro projects on the Cook Inlet? Or what is that engagement with industry looking like?
Through the chair, thank you for the question, Representative Mina. Yes, so we have several of these companies are engaging in different ways with the oil and gas sector. So if you look at, Kartorium is a really interesting company that has essentially an approach to create what are essentially like digital models or digital twins of key infrastructure. We've done a lot of work with them in microgrids and rural utilities, but they also, one of their key segments is the industrial sector and oil and gas in particular. They're a key one. We have a group called Water Pigeon that has a kind of fluid monitoring device that rather than someone from Alyeska Pipeline having to send out two or three folks to go check a meter on a pipe somewhere, you essentially put this device on the pipe and it sends a reading to the closest office. And so you're saving a huge amount of kind of labor to be able to monitor some of those things. Several of our companies are engaging with Aquaga is another group that's really interesting. It's one of our few Alaska companies that has a PFAS remediation technology. And that's a huge issue right now with some of the cleanup in the industrial sector. And so many of our companies have deep engagement with the oil and gas sector. And that's a key part of why we stood up the industry verticals, because we recognize that they're a key partner in all this work.
Yeah. Follow up.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, follow up. I appreciate that information, and it's great to see that engagement with the industry, because we need industry to be partners when we're talking about this transition. My other question is just related to part of the mission for Launch Alaska, which is to help catalyze Alaska's clean energy economy. How many of these portfolio companies are in Alaska? And for those that aren't in Alaska, what's that plan to engage them in Alaska's economy and, you know, potentially pull their services and their work up here?
Yeah, through the chair, thank you for the question. I think out of the 24 portfolio companies that we have at Launch Alaska right now, three of them are from Alaska. You have to remember that all of these companies, while they have different technologies and different approaches, at their core is some kind of cutting edge innovative technology. That's maybe another thing that defines a startup. And one of the things that we're hyper aware of in Alaska is that, you know, if you look at the number of SBIR, STTR awards, so these are federal research dollar awards, small business innovation awards, STTR, I'm blanking on the name of it. But essentially, these are technology development awards that multiple federal agencies award to startups who have some kind of a technology they're looking to commercialize. Alaska, performs usually 50th out of the 50 states in the country. Sometimes we perform, you know, 51st or 52nd because we get beat by, you know, Samoa and Puerto Rico. And this is a direct result of the University of Alaska system not being prioritized in terms of our funding for them. Not to wade into politics here, but you know, these companies, many of these companies, the majority of them have some kind of SBIR, STTR technology at their core, and then they work for a decade to develop a startup around that technology, and then they come to us to help get revenue or traction. So I just want to, maybe that's a side point, but just underscore the link between, you know, a well-funded university system and having local startups. The glass is half full side of this, which I think is exciting, is that, you know, the neat thing about having 21 companies from anywhere in the country or outside the country is that we have something unique in Alaska that these companies are really excited to come for. And they see an opportunity to deploy and to find revenue and to work in Alaska. And that's really exciting. And these companies, as I said, have huge ambitions and are high growth and are funded usually entirely by the private sector. It's not public dollars that are going in these companies. And so if we're interested in, you know, having some, high growth companies in Alaska, we have, I think, a really exciting value proposition for companies anywhere in the world to come to work here. So,
Representative Sumner has a question. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but if you please.
Through the chair, would it be possible to get a written list of these companies and a short blurb about what they do? Because, I mean, some of these are just the logo and it doesn't even have the name.
Sorry, yeah. There is a, if you, and I can send this as a follow-up. We have, if you go to our website, launchalaska.com/portfolio, and I'll send this to you as a link. There's a write-up on these companies. And there I can just briefly, we have two micronuclear companies on here, Oklo and Radiant. CalWave is a tidal generation company. We have Correlate, which is essentially a software to do large-scale energy efficiency plans for large commercial portfolios. Actually, instead of going through all of these, I'll send this as a link and a follow-up. But they run the gamut. There's quite an array. Interestingly, and apropos to today's conversation, one of the companies that we're excited about is a group called Zeroavia, which is a hydrogen aviation airplane manufacturer that Raven Alaska just purchased 30 hydrogen aircraft from, and they're in our transportation vertical. We'll talk about them a little bit more later.
All right, continue if you see no other questions.
Okay, and so that was a brief overview of Launch Alaska. One thing that I just wanted to underline here is that, as I said, we were founded in 2016, and we found a lot of interest, and we found it a very easy sell to companies with these exciting technologies to do work in the state. One of the things that we discovered after doing this work for about 3 years is that they would say, okay, you know, Alaska has some of these, some of the highest energy costs in the country. You have some of the highest energy consumption in the country. You have some huge logistics challenges and transportation challenges, extreme climatic conditions. Also, you know, Alaska has all of this, these superlatives around, you know, the world's largest tidal resource, the world's largest class 5 offshore wind resource in Lower Cook Inlet, also huge, you know, gigawatt scale resources of solar just right there, also in Upper Cook Inlet, more shoreline than the rest of the U.S. combined. There's all these superlatives that make Alaska an incredible place if you're a startup wanting to show that you can deploy your technology in a real-world setting and go through an Alaska winter and, you know, have your technology kind of beat up but then show that it operates and be able to then go from there to much larger markets. The thing that we discovered, though, is that if we don't have projects underway, if some of our infrastructure owners in the state are not issuing RFPs, or maybe they've had a series of assessments or studies done on how they can decarbonize and electrify their systems, but if those aren't being converted into actual projects, the startups don't have anything to bid on, or there's no, there's no activity for them to engage in. And so this is why a couple of years ago, we stood up the second part of the organization, which is these the innovation partnerships. And so this is where we're working with folks like the Port of Alaska or Kotzebue Electric or some seafood processors in Alaska to help them. They've said, okay, we've gotten these energy audits done. We've had these feasibility studies. We've had this research done. How do we actually get moving? Like, how do we get unstuck on this project and actually move forward? And so that's the side of our organization that's headed up by Rob Royce, who's our chief innovation officer. That's what they're doing, is they're going in and working with some of those asset owners or those infrastructure owners to actually get projects moving. And so that it's out of that side of Launch Alaska that we have become more and more interested in the kind of second topic of today, which is the potential for clean hydrogen in the Upper Cook Inlet of Alaska. And to set some context here, I think you all are intimately familiar with some of the economic headwinds for Alaska. We have, clear kind of long-term declines in our oil and gas production. And we, at least in the Rail Belt region, Upper Cook Inlet region, the current plan for natural gas is to import it, which to NSTAR's own forecast, or really anyone who's looking at this closely's forecast, will steeply increase prices if we do go down that route, not just for gas for heating our homes, but also for electricity generation. And if we want to think about what that does to home prices and the economy of a region, like look at places like Detroit or Pittsburgh, that kind of an economic change that we'll see. And so we have some clear economic headwinds that we all need to be very aware of. And there's also this potential right now with some of the infrastructure funding that's available to us to actually make this energy transition. And I don't think we have this opportunity forever. I think this is a once in a lifetime opportunity to have some non-dilutive federal dollars to make these projects happen. But so this is the context that I think we're operating in. And not to belabor the point here, the Alyeska Pipeline's own information about the throughput through the tap system. But this is the clear trend. Willow is a great little boost in this, but if you look at $180,000 of barrels of oil a year, out in 2027, maybe it's another Sharpie marker thickness of increase, but it doesn't change this general trajectory. We're still, as a state, looking at this long-term decline. And to make matters worse for us,
Mr. Vandenberg, Representative, before we get too far along, Representative McKay has a question, I think, on the previous, page 8.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I would be careful about how we define an economic headwind. The oil decline on the slope is pretty much government-induced from Washington, D.C. decline. There's plenty of oil reserves on the slope. We're just forbidden from developing it. If you look at ANWR, NPRA, Beaufort Sea, there's lots of reserves up there. So this is not an economic headwind. It's a government-induced headwind from Washington, D.C., and we see it every day in our headlines now. So I would challenge that statement. And then production on the slopes actually went up last year, over 500,000 barrels a day, and a jump from 500,000 to 200 with 280,000 barrels a day from Willow is a significant increase. So to dramatize this as we're on this some kind of, serious decline that's irreversible, I think is incorrect. And when it comes to all these other companies, are they doing this in China or Russia or India at all? And I believe not. So why are we pushing this so hard in our state? And you also said that the University of Alaska was seriously underfunded. There's lots of universities all over America, MIT, Stanford, University of Chicago, that can do research. Why does it just fall on us to pay for some of these things? So I have a lot of issues with some of your statements today.
Through the chair, thank you for the comments there, Representative McKay. We had a conversation recently with the head of AOGA, Karen Moriarty, and I think, there is pretty broad agreement that energy transition is underway. There may be some disputing if it's going to happen in 5 years or 10 years or 40 years, and that's a conversation that's worth having. But I think if we look at global numbers around, additional generation capacity for electricity, let's say, or just the cost declines on renewable sources of energy, it's pretty devastating. And this is not my own data. It's a clear transition that's underway that I think it's worth us being very clear-eyed about, because it's not an antagonistic thing. It's not renewables versus or oil and gas versus. It's, as a state, what do we want to do to become an energy state in the future, and how can we recognize with really clear eyes this transition that's underway, and how do we take a leadership role in it rather than being bowled over by it. I would also, I appreciate your comments. I would also take issue with the idea that this is just government. If we look, it's not just in the U.S., but elsewhere, the costs are driving this stuff. We've seen a 90% cost in the price of solar over the last 10 years. I mean, what that means is that even in Alaska, which, it's the land of the midnight sun, but we don't have necessarily the sunniest state in the world, we just saw a Willow solar project go soaring through the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And in order for the Regulatory Commission of Alaska to approve that project, they essentially had to acknowledge that solar was, cheaper than the avoided cost of energy for the utility over the course of the next 30 years. And this was before the infrastructure funds, or the infrastructure dollars were coming out, before Hillcorp made its announcements, before we've kind of seen all this additional investment going into this world. And so I appreciate what you're saying. I think Alaska should have access to its resources. I actually think that there's a really exciting role that Alaska can play if we're able to access some of our resources to spur on energy transition. But we got to be careful, because I think the markets are coming for us. And I think the investment dollars are out there, and the technologies, the cost declines are really hard for us to compete with. This should not be an antagonistic, thing. It should be us acknowledging that we have a really exciting role to play, and we're building this future as an energy state on, frankly, 6 decades of miraculous economic growth thanks to the oil and gas sector. Then we can parlay that into another, I think 100 years of economic growth as an energy state. But we've got to be clear-eyed about the economics of this. Like, policy, in my experience, policy eventually, not as quickly as we'd like sometimes, but eventually catches up to economics. And if we're not clear about the economics on this stuff, we're going to be left behind. But
so if I can interrupt you for just a second, Representative Stutz, welcome. Joined us at 1:30. Perfectly okay. We're all busy. If you wouldn't mind continuing, I'm excited to get to the hydrogen portion of it, because I think that's where our interests are going to dovetail.
That sounds great. Yeah.
I'm a solar panel owner myself, and I can tell you that solar is not the panacea. It's not going to work in Alaska unless it's accompanied by something else. So I run my entire house off of solar, and I think it's fantastic, but at least 3 months out of the year, it has to have a supplement of some sort.
Agreed. And I also think that there is there again is another really interesting opportunity. We have an especially acute problem in Alaska with, we have these dark, long winters that we all know very well. But seasonal storage, so, storage that's beyond just a couple of hours here and there, but can last for 2 months or 3 months, is something my colleague Dr. Whitney here will likely have some great comments on. But developing long-term seasonal storage is a challenge, and I think also a huge opportunity for us if we want to tackle that problem in Alaska. And there are companies out there that want to help us with that if we're open to them. Working with us on this.
We had a great seasonal storage, but it got shut down by the Enviros, the Susitna Watana. There's nothing better than storing water as a means of electric storage, right? But
yeah, this energy transition, I think some of the fault lines that we think are so clear start to get blurred.
Right.
These conversations are not simple and straightforward, very complicated. I just wanted to, not to belabor the point here, but, number of electric vehicles that are hitting the streets, which, I think by BP's own report recently, electric vehicle or transportation makes up about a third of the demand for their oil. If these are the kind of trends we're looking at in terms of global demand for electric vehicles and global deployment, what does that say about not just the volumes through TAPS, but also demand for our precious commodity here?
And I had a conversation, sorry to interrupt again, but with the manager of the Port of Long Beach, and he's totally against electric. He said that they're going to be all hydrogen within a decade. He said, electric vehicles, I'm not for it. It's not going to happen here. We're going to be all hydrogen. So he is maybe a step ahead of the rest of us. I suspect that Representative Vance has a horror story about electric vehicles and their usefulness in the winter in Alaska. But,
I would agree entirely. I think the Port of Long Beach has been a leader for a couple of decades. Ports and airports are two of the best use cases for hydrogen, and that's why I think we're in a really special position in the Upper Cook Inlet currently. I think vehicles, through the chair, I apologize for the experience that you had, Representative Vance. And I also think that light-duty transportation, even heavy-duty transportation, is probably not going to be a great candidate for hydrogen. Those forms of transportation are likely, I think, I'm doing a little bit of forecasting here, but I think are likely going to stay as electric and battery-operated, although I think we will see the chemistry of those batteries changing dramatically, and we're already starting to see that with companies like Form Energy, for instance, that are looking at other chemistries for batteries so that we are solving some of those resourcing issues, getting access to the rare earth and minerals that we need for the current battery chemistries. So I think chemistries are going to keep changing, but I think light duty, heavy duty, if I had a crystal ball, are going to stay electric. But hydrogen is a great technology for ports and airports, so shipping, long-haul aviation, and some other uses that we'll talk about here in a minute.
Representative Mina has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, quickly on the previous slide, because I also want to get to the hydrogen part, but in terms of this graph that we see, do we know what the rates of adoption for EVs are in Alaska?
I really wish I had my transportation lead with me here, Tim Leach. If I, through the chair, Representative Mina, if I can get back to you with that number, he would have it offhand, and I do not have it currently. So I'll follow up if that's okay. Yeah. And many of you are also aware, continuing to paint the picture that what we're doing isn't working currently, and that we need to be thinking about the future. Is, you know, the great folks over at the University's Center for Economic Development, Nolan Clouda and his team, did this report recently, just, you know, highlighting what a tough spot we are in with our state economy, and the current approach is not working, and we need to be thinking about what the next approach is, and just wanted to highlight that, underline that yet again. So one of my colleagues on my team, Rob Roizend, and Matt Najati, did a little bit of number crunching here. You know, we've heard a lot about the renewable resources that we have in Alaska and how massive they are. But it's hard for us to wrap our heads around that in any kind of tangible way. And I thought this kind of info chart this slide that Rob and his team put together, it was really interesting, which is that, you know, if we were able to tap into the amount of renewable resources that we have in the state, and we found a market for it, which that has always been the main barrier to developing these resources, is that, frankly, with, you know, 300,000 people on the rail belt, there just is not enough of a market to develop some of these renewables, and there's never been a way to get them, you know, to a market that's big enough. But they are there, and this factoid is just kind of really makes my, you know, takes me by surprise, which is that if you look at it from a BTU perspective, the amount of energy that we have access to, or amount of resources we have access to in Alaska from renewables, it could in 2 years produce what we've seen off the entire pipeline since oil was discovered in the early 70s. And that fact, or that way of looking at it, just helps me envision what we're talking about in terms of a potential valuable resource that has never been developed because there's never been a big enough market. We don't have anywhere to send this. These projects don't pencil out yet because we've never had anything to do with that. That tremendous potential. And so rehashing what I've just said here, it's historically been hindered by cost. Up until last decade, solar and wind have been too expensive, but that has changed in a dramatic fashion over the last decade. And the kind of cost barriers is being solved by natural gas. If we keep going down the road that we're going through, natural gas is going to be quite expensive, at least on the rail belt. And so here is where I think green hydrogen is something that we should be looking at very closely, because for the first time, clean hydrogen represents a potential market for those incredible renewable resources. For the first time, we don't just have to limit ourselves to thinking about, you know, the 300,000 folks living on the rail in Anchorage and people living on the rail belt as a market or in Alaska. We can now think about the global demand for hydrogen. And Dr. Whitney here will give us a much more detailed explanation of how you produce different forms of hydrogen. But just in brief, clean hydrogen is essentially taking renewables and converting that to electricity, and then through a process called electrolysis, producing hydrogen. There are multiple paths, multiple ways of creating hydrogen. The clean hydrogen is one that I think is really interesting right now, because again, through the bipartisan infrastructure law, the tax credits that are available, some of the incentives make this a a really interesting technology for creating hydrogen in Alaska. And that's also, incidentally, what some of the potential customers, the major airline manufacturers, major airlines, or aircraft manufacturers, airlines, the IMO, which is the governing body for international shipping, have all set really stringent targets on emissions reductions for shipping. And long-haul aviation is also under extremely extremely strict kind of targets to reduce their emissions profile. And hydrogen is a technology that has the potential to help those two sectors meet some of their emissions reductions goals. And so just looking at the kind of U.S. green hydrogen market, again, just one detail point. This is a fast-moving world around hydrogen. We used to use colors for hydrogen, and this this chart is from last year. They were still calling it green hydrogen. I think now we refer to it as clean hydrogen. And there are some rules. The IRS is currently working through some rulemaking to give clarity on what clean hydrogen actually means. But essentially, it's a using primarily renewable resources to create hydrogen. This is not a huge market yet, but is a rapidly growing market, $3.2 billion in 2021. And you'll see here, relevant to this committee, the transportation part of the market for hydrogen is the largest slice of the pie, and as well as power generation. And in particular, transportation in shipping and aviation are the two areas that make up the majority of the transportation.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, on the previous slide, so power generation, transportation, and others, what is others?
Actually, this is a good question. Do I know the answer to that offhand? I'll have to follow up with you through the chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Mina. I'm going to have to follow up with you. Oh, that's right. Industrial heat. Thank you. Industrial heat chemical manufacturing and kind of industrial processes. Gosh, I get in front of a committee and I lose about 30% of my intelligence. That's what's other. And I can follow up with you as well through the chair, Representative Mina, with more detailed information on that. But I think I've been so focused on transportation as power generation because of its relevance to Alaska and Upper Kitkin Lake right now at this moment. Just giving you a feel for these are real announced projects. And, I'm spending a lot of time looking at curves because I think as Alaskans we should be very aware of what the market, the kind of global curves are doing here and what this means for us. And these are announced markets by year. You can see that they go steep and up to the right. It's about as much detail as we need to dive into on this slide. And so then, as I said earlier, two of the best use cases for hydrogen are international shipping and aviation. And this is according to the International Energy Agency's report as of this last year. And there are also two areas where, from a global emissions perspective, we're having the most trouble making meaningful progress in. We refer to them as hard to abate sectors. The fact that we have an Upper Cook Inlet, the world's third or fourth largest cargo airport, as well as, the Port of Alaska, where, 95% of the consumer goods for the state come through. These are two really interesting pieces of infrastructure to participate in this hydrogen future. And not to belabor the point here, but this is just an overview of Upper Cook Inlet. It's got the Port of Alaska, right where the word Anchorage is, on the other side of the water there, Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport. And then really, if you draw a drop a pin in the center of this photo and take a 10-mile radius, you have gigawatt-scale renewable resources that are totally untapped, have the potential to be developed, again, with the will and with some direction. And this is a, an excellent place to think about hydrogen production in this region.
Representative Sumner has a question.
So through the chair, when you reference green hydrogen, are you talking about production of ammonia as a carrier for hydrogen, or are you talking about the actual electrolysis of water to form just free hydrogen? And how would you then store and transport? I mean, there seems like there's a storage problem with hydrogen gas, the volume. Are we filling up Zeppelins and using those instead of airplanes, or what are we doing here?
Through the chair, Representative Sumner, primarily, when I'm talking about clean hydrogen for this project, it's direct conversion of renewable energy into electricity into through electrolysis into hydrogen. The storage and distribution side of this, we should be clear-eyed about hydrogen. There are, there are things that we still need to work out. There are, again, here, though, it is not a unknown technology. We know how to store and distribute hydrogen. There's a company called Air Liquide that, through a subsidiary, is providing hydrogen to the Kodiak Launch Facility currently. There are electrolyzers that are operating currently in Anchorage, certainly, and I think in other parts of Alaska as well. So there is some engineering here that needs to be done, but there are big established players that know how to do this. And I also think, again, going back to this theme of energy transition, that one of the things a hydrogen hub really needs is people who know how to move fuel around and store volatile fuels and know how to, monitor pipes and heavy infrastructure. This is an area that the oil and gas sector has a lot of talent and a lot of know-how. And another company that we work quite a bit with that does a lot of work at the Kodiak Launch Facility, a local company called the Launch Company, is also very interested in helping with the kind of storage and distribution and is starting to look at this in addition to some of their work in Kodiak. So through the chair, Representative Sumner, am I answering your question there?
Sort of.
Good. Sounds like you must have.
Oh, and thanks. And yes, I keep forgetting that Dr. Whitney here can give us a much beyond my abilities can give us a technical breakdown of all the different ways that energy can work its way into different forms, different hydrogen carriers, including ammonia.
Representative Sumner.
Yeah. So through the chair, I guess I would be surprised that power generation was on there, because production of electricity to then electrolyze water, form hydrogen gas, and then the transport of that gas to then burn for power seems unconvincing. As far as the inefficiency that would be involved in that, and the loss of actual useful energy that would be involved in that many steps of process between generation.
Is through the chair, I can venture a response to this, but I really think if it's okay, if I can either invite Dr. Whitney to respond or save your question for when she's available. I don't know the proper protocol here.
Sure. Dr. Whitney, just put your name on the record and feel free to give it a shot.
Thank you. My name is Erin Whitney. I am the director of the Arctic Energy Office for the Department of Energy. I'm based in Anchorage, Alaska. So your question about the efficiency of using electricity to split water to make hydrogen, why wouldn't you just use the electricity directly? It's a great question. And if you're in a large grid, using that renewable electricity directly makes a lot of sense. But what if your renewable source is not connected to a grid, for example? It's, you know, hundreds of miles away from a grid, and you can't just use that electricity. You have no immediate use or immediate load for that electricity, right? Hydrogen provides a way to store and transport that electricity, that energy, as some commodity that can then be used somewhere else without transmission lines, which are very expensive to build, especially in our climate and our environment. So if you had a stranded wind resource, and when I mean stranded, I mean not connected to a distribution grid or a transmission grid, you could convert that to hydrogen, and then it could be converted to a hydrogen carrier, such as ammonia or methanol, that could then be shipped somewhere to be used. Does that make sense as sort of the differences in those two processes and in the different cases in which they might be used?
Sure, I suppose it does. I just, like, transporting free hydrogen seems like a daunting proposal as far as, you know, maybe there's some sort of, like, solid lattice structure that you can trap hydrogen gas in or conversion into a different chemical. But
right. Through the chair.
So transporting free hydrogen seems
right.
Surmount.
Through the chair, yes, compressed hydrogen, a gas, is much more difficult to transport than a liquid, which is why converting hydrogen to something like ammonia, which is a nitrogen and three hydrogen molecules, NH3, and is a liquid, is much easier to transport. So that's why we talk about not only the production of hydrogen, but the production of carriers of that hydrogen. So, for example, the shipping industry, Maersk, has made a commitment to producing methanol-powered ships. Methanol is another type of hydrogen carrier. It has four hydrogens embedded in the methanol molecule. So, again, using liquid because it is much easier to transport. Does that help?
So I have a question. How much is this going to cost? In other words, I get that one of the goals of many people is to reduce the carbon emissions, the hydrocarbons that we are emitting. But at what cost? I mean, I've read dozens of books about this, that we can spend trillions of dollars and not move the temperature needle globally a half a degree by our actions, that most of the temperature change, and this is a 30,000 foot level, I get that, but what's the cost of converting Maersk to hydrogen, or, you know, and what's the cost of putting ammonia in, you know, with all the whatever it's going to take to put in a vehicle to reconvert it to hydrogen? Is the cost going to be worth the benefit that we get? That's, I think, one of the big concerns that we all have.
Yeah, I would thank you for the question, Representative McCabe. So I would take that in a few different ways. One is that if you look at, on a very micro scale, the Willow Solar Project that in the Valley that was just approved to the RCA with 49th State Energy, you know, that project was built with private debt and tax equity dollars. It was a group based out of the East Coast. Believe me, I talked to all of the firms in Alaska that you would think of that might have some kind of interest in providing the debt and tax equity, and it just was not quite on their radar, although I think that will change very soon. But that project was entirely financed by a private infrastructure fund called Clean Capital, who, incidentally, we're inviting to present to us at a later date here through the House Energy, Special Energy Committee. Oh, sorry. Well, it didn't Willow. Anyhow,
I know what you're talking about.
I think it's actually called the Willow Solar Project, which is confusing. And so I think another data point here that we should be paying attention to is that the private sector capital wants these projects. We are not here saying the state of Alaska needs to buy a bunch of solar. We're saying let's get aligned around this economic opportunity and let the private sector provide this debt and tax equity. And I think that that not only has a couple of advantages. One is not just that we're not relying on, you know, public money for these projects, but also, you know, through the due diligence project, when you're building some kind of renewable project, the private investor does an incredible amount of due diligence on the viability of the project and also the ability of the local electric grid to accept that electricity and of the local infrastructure, because what they're doing is they're making sure that if they're going to put up the private capital, that the project is going to perform as advertised, and they will get these cash flows that they are relying on over the next 30 years. So it's going to cost money, but the thing that I just really want to drive home is that if we want the private sector to help us make this transition, these projects are what the private sector thinks is quality. This is what they want to spend money on. And there is, I mean, I don't want to overstate it, but there's an almost unlimited amount of private sector money available for these projects, and they want them. And you're seeing that. I mean, that's why it's some of those curves that I showed on other slides are so impressive. The Department of Energy also has a hydrogen shot initiative where they're setting this goal of 111, which helped me out here, Aaron, but I think it's $1 for kilogram per kilogram of hydrogen by 2031.
So in one decade from 2021.
And so, you know, there is some just like the same thing happened with solar. There was a DOE-led solar sunshot initiative that had a similar, you know, let's all align around driving down the cost. And it is an issue. Like, we do need to drive down the cost around hydrogen production. But my money is on the side of kind of the private sector to meet some of those targets and to get this done. I think the cost curves, both on electrolyzers and on renewables, are pointing us in that direction. So.
Thanks, Representative Sumner.
So through the chair, what's the BTU yield of a kilogram of hydrogen?
It's 33 kilowatt hours per kilogram. And what does that come out to in BTU? I could do a quick calculation and tell you.
Okay, please continue.
Okay, and so just again highlighting the economic benefits, potential economic benefits with this sort of a project, job creation, reduced energy costs, increased revenue for the region. I think Alaska, we're all aligned around the need to think big and to think about some big, big projects. And I think this is one that deserves a lot of attention. There are major incentives and investments available through the bipartisan infrastructure law right now. And I don't want to get too into the weeds here, but if you look at what some other regions are doing around clean hydrogen, one of the key challenges is this idea of additionality. In other words, is the project that we would develop here or that we develop for hydrogen actually additional to what a region would have done otherwise if there wasn't this facility? And I think thanks in part to the fact that we have not developed some of the renewables in this region in the past, and also the geographic area of this potential hydrogen facility, I think we're in a great spot to qualify for the additionality requirements that are still being worked on by the IRS and not hit the streets yet, but are essentially showing that this project could qualify for some incredible incentives. And I think that we should pay close attention to that, because that's a huge boom for the state. Also, one attribute of renewables is that you, when you build a project, you sign a power purchase agreement with an off-taker, and those power purchase agreements are usually, you know, 15, but we're usually now, you know, 30-year terms. And so when you build that project, you are locking in a cost of energy over a long period of time. There's no volatility. That's one of the great attributes and one of the reasons why investors like these projects also, is because they provide a stable price. And the more we deploy, the more stable that the price in the region can become. Again, private sector leading the way on this stuff. We're not here asking for you know, state of Alaska dollars to get these projects done, just alignment around a vision and support for a new sector. And also establishing a presence in emerging industries, something that I don't think we think about enough, but that, you know, portfolio companies that we're working with, also if we're trying to attract talent to the state, if we're trying to think about what kind of future industries or sectors do we not want to develop in the state, there is a lot of pressure on companies and a lot of demand from talent to be in regions that are looking at these future-oriented industries, these kind of decarbonized and clean energy industries. And this, when we talk about workforce development or, you know, keeping people here to work or young folks, you know, what kind of jobs do they want? These kinds of jobs, like it or not, these are what a lot of young folks and a lot of companies want to be a part of. And then attracting startups and innovators. So of our 24 portfolio companies, you know, we do our best when they arrive here to orient them to Alaska and to talk about the state. They are hyper aware of what our, you know, kind of state energy mix is, and also what kind of plans or direction that Alaska state leadership has for the state, because that tells them, is this a place that is going to be an area where I can set up shop and I can start manufacturing my hydrogen aircraft, because they have a friendly, they kind of have a friendly vision for the state. Is this a place where I can find the employees out of the university system that I need to join my firm as I grow? And I can't emphasize enough how zeroed in a lot of these companies are on our vision for the state and how important it is to them. And then last but not least, but supporting local companies and jobs through the energy transition. We, I think, are at a moment where there's a lot of anxiety, frustration, worry about Alaska's future and where are we headed and what's going to carry us for the next 50 or 100 years. I think projects like this suggest an answer. This is not a you know, a political partisanship thing. This is what is a bright spot? What's a major sector that we could wrap our arms around that we could see some incredible kind of, you know, job growth and companies coming in. If you look at the oil and gas sector, there's a ton of jobs tied directly to oil and gas. There are as many jobs in support industries and companies all around that sector. And this is no different. You know, one of the virtues of large-scale solar or wind is their low operations and maintenance costs. That's part of the reason why you know, those technologies are so cheap. There's not a lot of direct labor around solar and wind, frankly, but in all of the other industries that come about when you bring down the cost of energy, or you stabilize the energy, or you attract innovative companies who want to buy power from those clean sources, that's where all the upside is. And I just think it's worth us paying attention to.
Thanks. Representative Vance has a question, and we're going to have to whiz through these next few slides, or we're not going to get to Dr. Whitney's, all of her slides. So.
Thank you. Through the chair, you keep talking about projects like this, but you've been speaking for more than an hour and you haven't mentioned any project or given us an understanding of what the overall investment would look like you say that there's companies who are ready to invest in this, and I still don't have a picture of what that would look like or what a return on investment would look like.
Through the chair, thank you for the question, Representative Vance. So in December of 2022, we convened a group of folks for 2 days of road mapping to answer some of the questions that you're asking, Representative Vance. So in attendance were folks from the Port of Alaska, Ted Stevens, Chugach Electric was there. We had folks from private companies, ZeroAvia, the company we mentioned, another group called Universal Hydrogen. It's a producer, but also makes a hydrogen aircraft. Essentially getting people in the room, and also researchers and investors from the private sector, essentially come up with a roadmap of what could this project look like over the next 1, 3, and 10 years. And so to your point, this is we're very early on in the process, or we're essentially at a point where we're saying, okay, there is a really unique opportunity here that we need to start getting together some of the producers, some of the storage and distribution players, some of the end-use customers, the off-takers, as well as folks in the policy arena to look at this roadmap and start turning it into an actual project. Because at this point, it is an opportunity. There are some small plays happening. For instance, Raven Alaska just purchased, 30 hydrogen aircraft. Where we need to figure out by the time those aircraft are delivered, where is the hydrogen going to come from? Are we going to import it from, ship it in from Lower 48 in containers? That's one solution. Or are we going to produce it here? The Port of Alaska is currently looking at, obtaining an electrolyzer for some of the port side operations, as well as obtaining some hydrogen hostlers for port side operations as well. So there are small, which is great, I think, small individual bespoke projects that are starting to happen. And what our role has been today is just trying to convene some of these folks and create a bit of a roadmap that we can look at. And how does this, to answer your question, how do we actually wrap our arms around this project and make sure that it gets done over the next 10 years?
Follow up. So just so that I understand what your objective is not to bring this form of energy alongside the oil and gas. You want to replace it. Is that accurate?
So, no, it is not an antagonistic thing. What we see is that there is a decline in production and also in demand. And Hilcorp has made its announcement that they cannot guarantee future gas contracts beyond the current period for utilities. We think that there is a real need for us to think about what's next and to look out for the cost of energy for this region. And we need to be building as quickly as possible to get ready for that. The head of Hilcorp himself said, yes, Alaska should be looking at what's next after gas, and you should be thinking about energy efficiency, and you should be thinking about other sources. Like this is not, many of the folks who are kind of proponents of energy transition are the oil majors, are the companies who are saying, look, there's a change underway, and let's work together to figure out how this transition happens. But we need to be very careful to not frame this as one Alaskan versus another. It really is us as a state. How are we going to do this? How are we going to look out for jobs? How are we going to make sure that, we have our homes heated through this transition? How do we make sure that the electric grid, gets the upgrades it needs to make this transition? How do we look out for jobs? I mean, that's what I'm pushing for here.
Thanks. Let's move on, if you wouldn't mind.
Great. Yeah. And I can breeze through these slides. so that Aaron has enough time. Just reiterating quickly that our work with the Port of Alaska started with helping them with a port power plan, which is essentially a microgrid to improve port resiliency. And that has led to the port taking a very active role in thinking about their role in this kind of regional hydrogen world as well. And the port, I think, will be coming. I originally had these slides in here when we thought Jim would be here today, but I think I'll let I won't steal his thunder, and he can talk more clearly about the port and Raven. And just in conclusion, I just wanted to iterate, this is about an economic opportunity. This is something that I think has very little downside if we get moving and build as many renewables as possible. And heaven forbid, this the shipping and aviation market doesn't materialize, we'll still have a lot of renewables built, and that would be great. There's very little downside here to us moving forward on this. Again, puts us on a stable path to abundant electricity to light and heat our homes and power our vehicles, provides a long source of employment and jobs, and shows that we're open for the industries of tomorrow. Some last closing thoughts here. Massive increases in renewable energy production. One result of that convening that we had, that two-day convening in December, was that we're to meet the projected demand from the airport and the port, we're talking about gigawatt scale renewables. And to get that kind of production in time to meet the demand, we need to be having massive annual increases in the amount of renewables that we're building in that region. It's not ready for prime time yet, and the numbers still need some analysis and refining, but it's a almost unimaginable amount of energy that we would need to produce in that region to meet those hydrogen production goals. And I would also ask that, I know I'm talking to the House Transportation Committee, but this is closely tied to a state energy transition plan for the state, where we are asking all of these questions about what's being replaced, what are we building, what are we taking down, who, you know, which jobs are going where, how are we thinking a little bit advance of some of these prickly, thorny issues around energy transition, and how do we have a plan for this? And I think there is a great role for the university and for the national labs and researchers to work with the private sector to come up with an energy transition plan for the state. And it's, I feel, desperately needed. And last but not least, passing a renewable portfolio standard is something that we are very much in favor of. And thanks to Representative Sumner for introducing this on the House side recently. This is a kind of very important piece of legislation to get us moving more quickly, because I do feel we need to move more quickly.
Thank you. All right. So do we need to take a brief at ease here? Why don't we do that? Back on the record. So, Dr. Whitney, please place your name on the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you. My name is Erin Whitney. I'm the director of the Arctic Energy Office for the U.S. Department of Energy. A little closer? Okay, great. Okay, the Arctic Energy Office, if you are not already familiar with it, is part of the Department of Energy. It is the only regional office within the Department of Energy. No other region in the United States has a dedicated office such as this. And I report directly to the Undersecretary for Science and Innovation, who reports directly to the Secretary of Energy. I have been in this position for 2 months, but prior to that, I was a research faculty member at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, or ACEP, at UAF since 2014. And before that, was a researcher at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. I am an Alaska kid. I was raised in Anchorage, and am happy to be back here in Alaska since 2014 with my own family and raising my own kids here. The mission of the Arctic Energy Office is to bring the Department of Energy to the Arctic and Alaska and vice versa, to bring Alaska and the Arctic to the Department of Energy. It was first established in 2001 through the Defense Authorization Act, and then it was reestablished in 2019 by Energy Secretary Rick Perry and reauthorized. For the last 2 years, there's been an interim director, and I am the first permanent director. So, again, I want to emphasize that the office is a portal, really, for going between the state and the Department of Energy. The office has typically not had much of a presence here in Juneau, and so I'm grateful to have the chance to introduce ourselves here today and also talk a little bit about the technical aspects of green hydrogen, since that is the perspective that I come to the topic with as a researcher. I think that's probably enough to say just about the general office itself. I just want to make you aware of how we fit into the overall ecosystem and that you can use us as a resource if you're trying to get information about the Department of Energy. The Department of Energy, as I have learned in the last 2 months, is a many-headed monster, and it's hard to make sense of. So you can call us if you need information. We also liaise with all the national labs, so getting expertise from the national labs, opening up those communication channels, those are all things that our office can help with. And I'm located in Anchorage, so if you're in Anchorage, feel free to look us up and give me a call. And I will also say that you can interrupt me at any time with questions. As a university faculty member, I love questions. So the Arctic Energy Office does have a role in advancing hydrogen and green hydrogen in the Arctic and in Alaska. The Department of Energy has a National Clean Hydrogen Strategy and Roadmap that is currently under review. And the U.S. Department of Energy also has an overall Arctic strategy. And so our office works to implement those strategies. We do these missions by through a number of activities. One is that we facilitate the Alaska State Hydrogen Energy Working Group, which is currently engaged in a road mapping process. I personally facilitate that group, bringing over my expertise from my university sector. And it's a varied group. We have renewable hydrogen enthusiasts. We have oil and gas folks, because it really is a complementary and synergistic relationship, and there are lots of ways to make hydrogen, both from renewable sources as well as even from fossil fuel sources. So lots of people are working together in these pursuits, and I'll explain those different pathways in just a minute. I mentioned that we help implement the Arctic strategy, and we work with a variety of stakeholders from around the state and across the Department of Energy to implement these objectives. And then at the end of this presentation, I have a short slide just on some of the different hydrogen programs and tools that our office has, which I'd be happy to follow up with you in more detail later. So I hope this doesn't seem too basic, and I also hope it doesn't scare you, but I am a physical chemist by training, and I think it's important just to understand the chemical basics of hydrogen. Some of Representative Zimner's questions, I think, highlight for me the need to understand what is hydrogen, what are the carriers of hydrogen, what is green hydrogen, what is not green hydrogen. So I just want to cover a little bit of the basics so we have a common vocabulary and a good starting point. So hydrogen is two hydrogen atoms combined into a hydrogen molecule, and this picture here just shows hydrogen compared with other hydrocarbons, so hydrocarbons being hydrogen and carbon-containing molecules. We will be talking a bit about methanol. Methanol is a hydrogen carrier, meaning once hydrogen is made from whatever the source is, It can then be converted into a carrier, such as methanol. Another carrier that is not shown here that we talk about a lot is ammonia. So that's a nitrogen with three hydrogen molecules. And these other molecules on the picture are just other hydrocarbons. So, you know, these are things that make up, you know, what we might know as oil and gasoline and things like that. So it just shows that scale and range of hydrocarbons and how hydrogen fits into that family there. And this slide here is one of my favorite graphics explaining how hydrogen relates to other energy carriers. And it speaks to some of the challenges of working with gaseous hydrogen as well as liquefied carriers. So the largest graph here that has the gray and the green bars shows the volumetric energy density of different fuel options. So we talk about energy in terms of kilowatt hours or BTUs per a volume or per in this case per liter. So you can see on that bottom horizontal axis we have energy density in kilowatt hours per liter, and then we have different fuel types going up on the vertical axis. And so up on the top we have diesel, we have our hydrocarbons, and they are super energy dense, and that's why we love them. That's why we use them. We get lots of bang for that buck. You can see hydrogen, and it's listed at two different pressures, a 700 bar pressure, which is twice as much pressure as a 350 bar pressure. That's gaseous hydrogen. Not as much energy density per volume because it's a gas instead of a liquid. But when we start to look at converting hydrogen to carriers, such as ammonia or methanol, you get a higher energy density. And that's why these carriers are so attractive, is because the energy density increases, you know, several times from that of gaseous hydrogen. Yes?
So, Representative Sumner.
So through the chair, sorry. So what would be the advantage of methanol? If we're trying to decarbonize? I mean, I'm not a chemist. So.
That's a great question. And that's exactly the kind of conversation I was hoping to catalyze here. So you're exactly right. Methanol has a carbon in it. So how is it decarbonizing anything? The way people are thinking about trying to make methanol from hydrogen is to use carbon dioxide, which can be pulled from the atmosphere or from fossil fuel feedstocks. So it's a way of taking that carbon away, out of some source and then turning it into a carrier. But yes, then again, you burn methanol and you emit that carbon again. But it is a way of not making any new carbon emissions.
All right, please continue.
So what I just described there is the large graph showing that comparison of volumetric densities. But where hydrogen becomes exciting and potentially very impactful is when you think about the specific energy. So that's the energy per unit mass. And this relates to the question that Representative Sumner asked about number of kilowatt hours or that energy density per mass. So you can see in the small inset graph there, hydrogen energy density is 33 kilowatt hours per kilogram. And the green bar and the blue bar are they're separated by what's called the latent heat vaporization. Don't worry about that. Just think about the average of those two bars there. But the take-home message here is that when you compare the specific energy of hydrogen, so the energy by unit mass with that of traditional fossil fuels, diesel, for example, it's 2 to 3 times what you have for those fossil fuels. So if you can compress hydrogen, if you can liquefy hydrogen, if you can put it into some kind of a carrier form, you potentially have a very, very energy dense
fuel relative to traditional fossil fuels. So I've compared there. Hydrogen has a specific energy of 33.6 kilowatt hours per kilogram, and that's, you know, 2.5 to 3 times that of diesel, which is, you know, 12 to 14 kilowatt hours per kilogram. So that's the real promise. But again, you know, getting that hydrogen into a form where you can actually take advantage of that of those mass density considerations, that is a challenge. But what I hope this imparts to you is what some of the challenges and opportunities are with regard to, say, gaseous hydrogen as opposed to liquid carriers, and helps to elucidate some of these differences in the energy capacity of these different carriers. So this is just a simple breakdown of what we mean when we talk about green hydrogen relative to other types of hydrogen. And Isaac made the comment earlier that the world is sort of moving away from the use of different colors, but you still hear about it. And in fact, I think today's presentation was even titled Green Hydrogen. So I think it's worth just understanding what that means. Green hydrogen is hydrogen that's made from renewable resources. So using renewable electricity to electrolyze water, and because you're just electrolyzing water, which is hydrogen and oxygen, the outputs are hydrogen and oxygen with no carbon outputs. That's different from gray or blue hydrogen, where you are using fossil fuel feedstocks, and the outputs are not only hydrogen, but also carbon dioxide. When we talk about blue hydrogen, we are talking about sequestering that carbon dioxide, so turning it into something else, maybe putting it into a carrier fuel, such as methanol, sequestering it in a storage facility or, you know, a natural storage structure, like an underground reservoir of some sort. And so that's what makes blue hydrogen. And then gray hydrogen is primarily how hydrogen is made today, where you have a natural gas fuel stock and you make hydrogen as well as CO2 that just goes into the atmosphere. So I hope that makes those differences clear. Yes.
Sure. So I have a question about what point do we figure that too much oxygen is not a good thing for growing trees and plants and everything else? In other words, we emit a certain amount of CO2, and it's good for the trees, it's good for the plants and all that. I get that too much is not good, but too much oxygen would not be good as well, correct? Or am I thinking about that wrong?
He stumped her.
Well, I guess I'm trying to figure out,
sorry,
Representative McCabe, where this question is coming from, because we haven't been talking about oxygen as an output.
So I'm looking at the green energy.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, yes.
H2O, obviously, if it's, we are putting out oxygen, right? I mean, and so one of the byproducts of splitting hydrogen is the oxygen. So in green energy has no CO2 as an output or as a byproduct, if you will, or very little, I guess. So we start putting out a bunch of oxygen. We're worried right now about CO2 output and CO2 in the atmosphere. Will there come a time in 100 years or 200 years where we're worried about, where we've made this great transition and now all of a sudden we're worried about too much oxygen in the atmosphere? Maybe, if, you know.
I don't think so. I mean, when someone goes to the hospital and they get put on pure oxygen, I never hear any complaints, right?
Right. Well, for us, that's absolutely true, but what about for the plants? I mean, you know, you couldn't put a tree on pure oxygen and it would die, right? I mean, it has to have CO2 as part of its, you know, for growing and as part of the photosynthesis and everything.
I think you pose a very interesting question. I don't think that's a risk, though. There's lots of radical scavenging of oxygen in the atmosphere.
and it doesn't have, I don't think that's a risk, but I think it's a very interesting question. So thank you.
Representative Sumner.
Through the chair, I think perhaps the, well, first of all, the combustion of the hydrogen would reabsorb the oxygen. But, I mean, aside from that, you know, the additional forest fires from 10% higher oxygen or whatnot would fix that problem pretty quick. And everything rusting. So I don't think that's problem. A concern, right?
All right, I stand corrected. I'm going to come back in 200 years and see if you're right. All right.
Now you've got me thinking. So this just underscores hydrogen production today. And most of the hydrogen that's made in the world today is made with a natural gas fuel stock. And that's the gray part of this graph. And that natural gas without CCUS stands for natural gas without carbon capture and underground storage. And then there is a large fraction of the world's hydrogen that is made from coal today. You see that a lot in China. And I know someone's going to ask me, what are the byproducts? And I don't know what all is in that aqua blue chunk of the graph. But what I can tell you is that the message here is that most of our hydrogen is made from natural gas today. So I just want to highlight the current state of hydrogen production in the world.
So natural gas with CCUS is what we call blue natural gas.
Blue hydrogen right. Made from natural gas with carbon capture.
Right. So what do we call coal with when hydrogen's made from coal with CCUS? Still blue hydrogen?
Maybe slate blue. I don't know if there's a word for that. I know that hydrogen made from coal without carbon capture is called brown hydrogen. So you'll have to find a color that's a cross between brown and blue.
All right.
To answer that question. And I will say that the colors are sort of going out of vogue these days because, I mean, there's like 12 different colors of hydrogen, and it gets really confusing. And so I think the vocabulary is moving towards clean and non-clean.
Please continue.
Okay. So with a little bit of, with a few of those fundamentals, I just want to highlight, I want to go back to what the big picture motivations are here. And one of the drivers here is the amount of CO2 or the amount of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. We've been warned by scientists that, you know, we are approaching dangerous levels of global warming, which, you know, has implications for our oceans, for our storms, for permafrost thawing in the Arctic, for lots of different effects. And hydrogen is a way to get at decarbonization or taking CO2 out of the atmosphere. But it's not the only driver. So let me just go to the next slide while we hold on to this thought here. Hydrogen is a way to decarbonize hard to decarbonize sectors of our global greenhouse gas emissions. So, for example, this is a chart of global greenhouse gas emissions by economic sector, and carbon dioxide is what we know is a greenhouse gas. It's one of the prominent, most well-known greenhouse gases. And you can see here, and this is from, I believe it was from 2021. I'd have to go look at the source there at the bottom of the slide to be sure. But you can see here the big players are from industry. So this is, you know, cement making, chemical industry, electricity and heat production, so burning natural gas, you know, to make electricity and heat. Transportation, so you know, our planes, our ships, our cars, our trucks, all of those put huge amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and also in agricultural emissions, forestry, and other land uses are all sources of
carbon dioxide. The other driver I want to talk about, though, is if the environmental angle, you know, is not one that resonates with you, is one of security. I had the great privilege to spend some time in Germany last year as a Fulbright scholar, learning about hydrogen advances in Europe. And I was there, I arrived in Germany right after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And Germany gets a large chunk of its natural gas, or did get a large chunk of its natural gas from Russia. And it's not just an environmental concern, taking natural gas or fossil fuel emitting sectors out of the economy, but it's about energy security. And, you know, Germany and many other countries are thinking about how to shift their energy source portfolios so that they can have other sources of energy other than, you know, what they might get from Russia. So, you know, Germany is ramping up its plans to make hydrogen, as are other countries in that area and around the world. So there are multiple drivers for a conversation about diversifying our energy sources. This is a graphic that is shown in a lot of Department of Energy publications, but it's existing and emerging demands for hydrogen, and it just goes to show how versatile hydrogen can be, assuming it meets, you know, economic and cost targets as well. It can be used in transportation applications. Isaac spoke to shipping applications and transportation and aviation applications. It is used in the chemical and industrial applications quite heavily. So anytime you make ammonia for fertilizer, you're using hydrogen. Anytime you make methanol, anytime you refine oil. I mentioned steel and cement manufacturing and industrial heat. Power generation applications as well. As we think about using hydrogen to make power and make heat, we're talking about using fuel cells. We can talk about combusting hydrogen directly. We can talk about using hydrogen as a way to store energy to be used later. So all of this is trying to communicate is just the versatility of hydrogen as a fuel source in a variety of different applications, which is why it is so attractive as a way to infiltrate our energy ecosystem, if you will. Yes.
Representative Mina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, so looking at this graph from DOE, which of these examples of hydrogen demands do we see in Alaska? I know that Mr. Vandenberg mentioned that Raven Alaska is working at some hydrogen aviation in their industry. What other examples are there?
So that's the example, excuse me, through the chair.
No worries.
That is great. The example that Isaac mentioned is one of a committed project. Other potential uses in Alaska in light of, say, for example, uncertain Cook Inlet gas supplies could be, you know, the seeding of hydrogen in our natural gas supply for both power and heat generation. One can put small amounts of hydrogen into natural gas supplies that can then be used without any major retrofits for heating applications and for power applications. There are no committed projects right now, but it's something that is being talked about as a way to, you know, extend the natural gas supplies that we do have. Shipping is also something that's being talked about. You know, with Maersk, the global shipping giant, making transition to methanol ships, and with Alaska being the major, you know, shipping stopover that it is, that is another sector that is also considering hydrogen or hydrogen carrier fuels. And you have others to add there, Isaac?
Yeah, I would also just add that while during my presentation I was focused on the Upper Cook Inlet, you know, that focus, I also think actually just today there was an announcement that, you know, both Norway and a group out of the lower 48 are kind of on the same day testing, two different companies testing hydrogen ferries. And I know that the RFP for the testamine replacement, I think, includes some future proofing for potential hydrogen in the future as well. And then just wanted to also highlight the long duration energy storage, which I think you mentioned, Aaron. I also know that there are a couple of groups looking at the possibility of cement manufacturing in Alaska as another really interesting use case. That's it.
Thank you. Please continue, Dr. Whitney.
Thank you. I'll also add, in response to Representative Mina's question, that it's not just the in-state demands, but the demands outside of our state that's driving this conversation. And a number of the Asian countries have energy plans that mandate the acquisition of clean hydrogen fuels for their decarbonization targets beyond what they can supply domestically. And I think that external demand is what is driving conversations about Alaska's potential to be a supplier because of our, not only our location relative to these countries and our location on these shipping routes, but also because of the resources that we have. We have stranded renewables that Isaac mentioned that could be harnessed. And, you know, I will also say, you know, there was a hydrogen hub application put in to the Department of Energy that ultimately, you know, was not hydrogen, but it was the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation that led that proposal. And their whole premise of their application was to use natural gas from, you know, a pipeline that would be constructed to make carrier fuels such as ammonia or something like that from, you know, out of the Nikiski Agrium plant that could then be exported to countries outside of Alaska. So there are places for players in all parts of the ecosystem, energy ecosystem, in this equation. And honestly, it's that external demand that will create the economy of scale that may be needed to make it economical.
Thank you. Let's continue. We get about 10 minutes to do four slides. So.
Okay. This is just a quick cartoon that I made that explains some of the possibilities for Alaska, and we've talked about it already in general terms. But starting with production, on the left there, you have non-fossil fuel sources, so you know, renewable energy, fueling electrolysis of water to make hydrogen. You also have fossil fuel sources, so natural gas, for example. So we make hydrogen from those sources. That hydrogen can also be converted to carrier fuels, such as ammonia or methane or methanol. And then those fuels, hydrogen or its carriers, can be used in fuel cells. They can be combusted directly. They can be mixed with other fuels. And those can be used in a variety of applications. So we can use fuel cells, for example, for power. That's the traditional application. We can use fuel cells for transportation, you know, for hydrogen airplanes, for example. When we combust hydrogen directly, that can be used for heat. It can be used for power. And then when we combine hydrogen and It's carriers with other fuels that can be used for all of these applications, heat, power, and transportation. And the opportunities that I see in Alaska are across the entire state. So we have rail belt opportunities, that Isaac concentrated on in his presentation, heat and power and transportation. But we also have opportunities for our remote communities. They are interested in a security standpoint in having a locally sourced fuel that is not subject to the whims of when it's available or when it can be shipped into their communities, and being able to make something like hydrogen locally combined with other energy sources, and to be able to store hydrogen or its carriers over longer time periods can be a step towards greater energy security for those communities. And then we also have the export case, which I just described as a way of creating an economy of scale.
Okay.
And then I just have this graph here because I think it gives a sense of the scale of what we're talking about here. And numbers always make me feel a little more comfortable. So these are energy consumption estimates taken from the Energy Information Association website, EIA website, from 2020. I couldn't find anything more recent. But it shows you here on a yearly scale here. So we see natural gas, which is the bulk of our energy consumption. And I think that number is mostly indicative of rail belt consumption, both for heat and for power. And those are both approximately equal quantities, which sum up to that total natural gas consumption. But what I think is really important here, and related to the transportation aspect of this, because this is the Transportation Committee, is the jet fuel consumption. That is a huge amount of jet fuel, and these are all on the same scale. These are all in BTUs amounts. And if you think about that natural gas number as being, you know, half heat and half power, right, for the belt, the rail belt, jet fuel is almost as much as either our power consumption or our heat consumption for the rail belt there. And that number is only growing. On any given day, the Anchorage International Airport is, the second or third busiest airport in the world. And, we also have airports all over the rest of the state that are contributing to that number as well. So, again here, what I want to highlight is just the intensity of consumption of these different sectors, especially the transportation sector, as indicated, or as which includes jet fuel as well as other modes of transportation. But this is just a number here to stick in your craw.
Okay.
And then just some more numbers. Again, I like to put these up because it highlights the scale of the problem or the challenge or the opportunity, however you'd like to look at it. The rail belt has an annual electric load of about 600 megawatts, give or take. And if we were to supply all of that with hydrogen, which we're never going to do, but it provides an upper limit, that would require about 300 million kilograms of hydrogen if we wanted to meet 100% of that load. What I want to compare that to is some of these other global estimates. So the EU, the European Union, has set a target of 10 billion kilograms of domestic hydrogen production, and that same amount of renewable hydrogen imports by 2030. So 10 billion. This is how big this global demand is going to be. And then China has similarly large numbers. And I think the point here is that we have incredible energy resources in our state, both fossil fuel as well as renewable, and that the size of the global demand is really something we should take heed of in terms of marketing our energy resources, not just our fossil fuel sources, but also these other sources that are untapped. There's an incredible opportunity here beyond just what our own in-state needs are. And I think that that is something to keep in mind as we're thinking about the scale of this opportunity ahead. And finally, I promised you some tools. These are things that I can send more information about later. We have city partnering programs. There's matchmaker tools. There's the hydrogen shot there that Isaac mentioned in terms of cost targets. I mentioned the hydrogen hub application there at the bottom. These are all things that the Department of Energy is working on nationally and that the Arctic Energy Office is keeping its finger on the pulse of to make sure Alaska and the Arctic can benefit from some of these tools. So I leave you with some resources, and I'm happy to follow up.
Very cool. Representative Sumner. Oh,
through the chair, did you say that HEDC applied to the hydrogen hub and they were, encouraged or discouraged from doing a full application?
The Alaska Gasline Development Corporation led, through the chair, the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation led the Alaska application. It was not encouraged, but what it did do is bring a lot of stakeholders around the table to talk about how to work together across both fossil fuel and non-fossil fuel energy suppliers to potentially create a hydrogen economy in the state.
Okay, thanks. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair. Through the chair, just a quick comment. It's interesting to see that China's currently the largest producer of hydrogen. So thinking back to Rep. McKay's comment on whether they do this in China or India and other countries, I'm interested in a follow-up on how Alaska can keep America competitive with hydrogen production given the growing global demand for it.
Yes, and through the chair, I think that this is one of the advantages that Alaska has is actually to be a hydrogen exporter more than probably any other region in the United States. So it is both our challenge as well as our advantage.
Okay, any other questions? All right, seeing none, I'd like to thank Dr. Whitney and Mr. Vandenberg and all those who contributed to the presentations today. Thank you for being here. There's no committee meeting this Thursday. Mr. Witt will be in touch soon with members' offices to inform them of next week's committee plan. Likely there will be, I think we have a couple of resolutions that we're working, and we've been passing those to you, so hopefully you're getting those. If you have any comments, feel free to reply or get those to my office, and we'll try to make changes or whatever meets. So, see no other business before this committee.